Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has served his country with distinction, both in uniform with the United States Navy and in civilian offices, including that of the Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement in the George W. Bush administration, is our first guest. He is Robert Charles. It's always good to have him with us. Welcome back, Robert. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to take stock with you, both as a trained lawyer as well as a serious national security professional, about the significance, the president talked about it last night in Ohio, of this Supreme Court ruling with respect to his authority to move funding to actually construct border barriers. You've talked on this program and elsewhere a lot about the importance of those barriers, so we probably don't need to dwell on that, but the importance of his ability to actually construct them is something I really would like to get your thoughts on. How important was this victory in the Supreme Court?
You know, this is one of those victories which gets little attention, but is actually an inflection point, I think, a significant inflection point. And history is made by inches. And what happened is on July 26th, the United States Supreme Court came down with a ruling essentially allowing the president to transfer $2.5 billion from the defense programs over to construction of the border wall. And many will say, well, that's just about maybe one-tenth of the number, $25 billion, that he has sought. Others will point out, and they're right, that the cost of the United States is estimated in the range of $165 billion of these crossers and the illegal drug trafficking. But the significant piece of this, you really have to see the progeny of how this case came about to understand where it now points, which is in a good direction. What happened in February is the president recognized openly a crisis on our border and declared a national emergency, which is actually a term of art. It's not a call to arms. And a lot of people thought, including a lot of Democrats in the House and Senate, that he was off base. Well, actually, in March, April, May, and June, we broke records, 12-year records for crossings. And we know what those numbers are. The May number was 144,000, which is really remarkable. The others were slightly below that. So what happened? Of course, these people have no legal right to be here, and it really did put the punctuation point, the exclamation point, on his national emergency declaration. An Oakland, California judge, a federal judge, 49-year-old Obama appointee, decided this was too much, and in just before the May numbers came out, he put a preliminary injunction in place and blocked the president's ability to transfer the money to the border. Interestingly, a D.C. judge, Trevor McFadden, changed, ruled the other direction. And then this Oakland, California judge named Hayward Gilliam turned around and slapped a permanent injunction on the president's ability to transfer the money. And that directly affected the ability to build gap-filling wall components at El Paso, Texas, and Yuma, Arizona. All of a sudden, July 26 comes along and there's a 5-4 ruling of the Supreme Court saying three things. First, that the transfer was entirely legal and permissible. Secondly, that the national emergency was ample to warrant the transfer. And third, that that permanent injunction would not hold. Now, understand this is part of a process, and we still have the full on the merits argument in that case to be heard. But three things really come out of that that are significant. First, the president can begin to construct something he should have been able to construct 2.5 years ago. Of course, the irony in all this is that he wasn't given the money for something that now Congress complains is creating a humanitarian crisis and that we have too many people and too few asylum judges and too few detention facilities. But that was really because Congress didn't give them the money. The second thing that's interesting is that Stephen Breyer, a big liberal on the court, did not did not come down with the majority, but he did say that the president has the authority to initiate the contract preparation. And frankly, there's almost no legal difference in my mind between saying the president has the authority to do the contract and the president has the authority to build a wall. And the last thing I think is that this is really the tipping point. This is something that indicates that the president's long drive to secure the border, together with detention facilities that are humane, will prevail. And I'm not saying it's not a guarantee, but we're headed in the right direction for the first time.
Well, that's encouraging, to say the least. But as you say, there does still need to be further fulminating at the district court level about some of the substantive issues in connection with this case. But hopefully this will be, as you say, an inflection point and a breakthrough for getting the border secure.
I think what the president, in a 5-second piece here, what the president has said again and again is that I'm right on the law and I'm protecting America and I have the right to do it. And this case basically tips you in that direction and says, the president's right.
Yeah. How refreshing. You wouldn't know it from listening to the Democratic debaters, of course, over this past week. We had two nights worth of fulminating by them. Robert Charles, two questions. One is they've addressed themselves with some insistency to these border issues, rather unimpressively, to my way of thinking, but I'd like to get your thoughts on it. They've not addressed themselves, it seems very much, to a whole host of other national security and foreign policy problems that I know we agree warrant close attention and public education in connection with this upcoming national election, no?
So let me hit both those points. First, in terms of what people saw as a spectacle, I mean, only about 1 million of the 350 million of us Americans watched these debates. But of those that watched and then read the newspapers later, one of the most remarkable things is that it was really more like a schoolyard juvenile brawl. It was a name-calling match. A couple people said they wanted to punch the president. Oh, that was it. That's a very dignified way to run for office. They accused each other of false statements of fact, which ironically, they were right when they accused each other of false statements of fact. For example, Harris was accused of not admitting that the Medicare for All plan that they chiefly all buy into actually makes employer insurance illegal. Well, I've read the text of both bills. It's exactly what it does. So there's a lot of dissembling. Probably the factual part that bothered me the most was they said, seven children died in detention. We're talking about almost 1 million people having been detained over the course of this administration as yet. But seven people died to children during the Trump administration. What they didn't say is that during just one fiscal year, from October 2014 to September 2015, there were 13 deaths in CBP custody under Obama. And actually, under ICE detention under Obama, there were 67 people who died in detention between the ages of 24 and 49, and some of them for use of force. So, the irony here is that hypocrisy doesn't seem to stick anymore, and that's very disappointing. These are a bunch of really, I think of them as little leaguers trying to take on Babe Ruth, who keeps pushing, looking up at the sign and pointing and saying, "Here's where we're going to go," and goes there
consistently. Yeah, and we're just out of time here, Robert, but I guess the short form of it is it fair to call what the Democrats are espousing, for shorthand, open borders?
Well, I think it is fair, and I think it omits discussions about Iran and China and some of the big issues in America that we face as Americans in protecting the free world.
We're going to come back to that with you in the very near future. Robert Charles, thank you for your time today. Come back to us again soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by our friend and colleague, Kevin Freeman. He is the star of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman at Blaze TV. He is also the author of two extraordinarily important books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He blogs at globaleconomicwarfare.com, and you can find out more about his television program and, in particular, get some extraordinarily valuable blueprints for action at economicwarroom.com. Kevin Freeman, it is a delight to have you back. I had the pleasure of spending the day with you, much of it yesterday, as we taped a program for an upcoming show by Bill Walton. And it was great to have the opportunity to talk with you and Bill, and then to visit a bit on the margins of it all. Thank you very much for your time yesterday and for joining us again today.
Oh, both yesterday was phenomenal, and enjoyed the time we had together, and appreciate always being here.
Good. Well, it's always good to have you, too. You're back home, and I wanted to sort of just take stock with you on a couple of things that you've been mulling. You've written recently about the sort of anomalous situation, and we talked a little bit about it with Robert Charles in the first segment, but only in glancing. This is a moment when we are hearing precious little from the Democratic candidates for president about their thinking about the world. To the extent we have, it seems as though they're more preoccupied with what may be a complete red herring, honestly, of Russian interference with the election processes. Not that they're not trying, but that seems not to be having much effect as a practical matter. But that doesn't begin to compare, I think it's fair to say, Kevin, to the challenges that we're facing from some other quarters, notably China. And you've written a piece recently about it being the greatest external threat. Tell us your thinking on the subject.
Well, Frank, you know, there's no question. I've written for 10 years, and we've talked quite a bit, that Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation are seeking their place in this world, and often to our detriment. But yet, despite that reality, and I think we wrote a book about the Russian bear's back, basically, despite that reality, China is a much greater threat. Their economy is substantially larger than Russia's economy. I mean, Russia's economy is roughly tantamount to the size of Texas' economy. And so, you know, China is a much greater threat, and China is much more belligerent. China is a communist nation. So, you know, the idea that we should focus on Russia, Russia, Russia is just ludicrous. In fact, the whole Russian narrative, you know, in some ways may be part of what China wants to see happen.
Yeah, look over there, folks, not over here, as they say. And when you talk about the threat from China, Kevin Freeman, I know one of the things that has been a particular focus of your effort for a long time is raising awareness about this book that we talked about at length with Bill Walton, namely Unrestricted Warfare, the kind of blueprint that it represents for not just what the Chinese could do to actualize that threat to us, but what they're actually doing. Tell us a bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, it's a 20-year-old book. It was written by two senior colonels of the People's Liberation Army, who are both now senior generals. And it is their blueprint. They looked at the end of the 1990s, they looked at our economy and our military and everything else, and they said there's no way to catch the United States and become the preeminent nation that we want to be, suppressing the United States without engaging in unrestricted warfare, things like intellectual property theft, things like hacking, things like manipulation of the culture and so forth. And so they laid out a plan, and as you read it, it looks more like history than it does a plan, because those are the very things that we know and have caught the Chinese doing. And their goal is to repress America and bring China to the forefront and literally dominate the world.
And unfortunately, some of the techniques that they're talking about are not strictly economic warfare instruments. There are means by which they could destroy, for example, our electric grid. They haven't, fortunately, done that so far, but they certainly understand our vulnerabilities in that department and seem perfectly prepared to pursue it. The contrast between sort of a sensible strategic understanding of what the Chinese are up to and the what passes for sort of the addled thinking of the left on these issues seem to me to have been captured pretty nicely in a piece that was written by Jake Warner in The Nation the other day. It's titled "Why Confrontation with China Threatens the Progressive Agenda." And I thought, you know, it's reminiscent of the old line about, you know, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. China may not be terribly interested in your progressive agenda, but the extent to which you ignore that reality in pursuing it is a formula for disaster, it would seem to me. Your thoughts?
Well, among the Democratic candidates, for example, and senior Democratic leadership that's been around a while understands, like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have displayed that they understand that at least China is a threat. Elizabeth Warren's talked about China being a threat. But the young elements in the Democratic Party, the ones that are capturing all the attention and excitement, they completely dismiss it. And I suspect that the Chinese are involved in American politics. I suspect that they continue to use culture, influence, and money to try and – this is a communist regime, and they would love to see the Democrat Socialists of America, for example, in a strong position here. So the Democratic Party is highly conflicted on this issue, and fortunately, the Republican Party, at least the pro-business, pro-global, free-trade-at-any-cost elements of the Republican Party, they're also conflicted. But the truth is the truth. China is a threat. It's an economic threat. It's a military threat. It's a national security threat in every single respect, and we need to be aware of that and address it. It's not just a trade issue.
It's certainly not just a trade issue. But let's talk a little bit about the trade issue. Well, we're on the topic, Kevin Freeman. There's in the next segment going to be a conversation with Bradley Thayer about Hong Kong. I won't get into that with you other than ask the question. To the extent that the Wall Street Journal has it right in describing the White House as communicating to the American government, you know, sort of senior ranks, don't raise a ruckus about what's going on in Hong Kong, lest it complicate further our efforts to get a trade deal with Beijing. What are your thoughts on that, Kevin? Is this, in fact, advisable? Are we likely to, you know, both get a bad outcome in Hong Kong and probably, if any, a pretty bad trade agreement as well, if we go down that road?
First off, I was in Washington, as you know, and I met with several senior officials associated with the Trump administration. I'm not certain that the Wall Street Journal has it correct. You know, I do have a fear that we want to get a trade deal at whatever cost so it looks politically good, and that would be a real risk here. But this is an opportunity for the president right now. The unrest in Hong Kong is horrible. They're going back on their promise. They're reneging on their promise of one country, two systems, and trying to impose communist control over Hong Kong. And the people there are obviously upset about it and willing to demonstrate on it. And this is a weakness that China has now, at the same time that they've got to watch the Democratic debates and seen, you know, the field of candidates against the president is looking less formidable. So the idea of waiting him out is it seems maybe a little less likely. This is a moment of strength, and I think the president demonstrated that when he raised the tariffs yet again. He ratcheted up pressure while they're under pressure, and I think the stay the course, don't give in just so we sell more soybeans in China. We cannot just strike a trade deal just so, well, we'll bring some short-term money back to the United States. We've got to right now confront an existential threat that this very moment may be our last chance to do so.
Yeah, I feel very strongly that's the case. Let me ask you about those ratchet-up trade tariffs, Kevin Freeman. There's a lot of talk at the moment on the left in particular, that this is going to cost American consumers and businesses dearly. What's the current impact been on the various items that have been tariffed so far? And do you anticipate that there will be a huge burden imposed on Americans if the president follows through on this threat in September?
Well, you know, free traders will say, oh, if you put tariffs on that, it's just going to raise consumer prices rapidly. And we haven't seen that in the inflation data. It's just not there. In fact, the part of the reason the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates is because they're not anywhere close to their inflation target, and the fear is a little more deflation. What we've done with the tariffs so far is expose that China is more dependent on the United States than we are on China. They buy very little of our goods and services. And, you know, we can find other suppliers. It may take a little bit of time, but there are workers in Vietnam, in India, and Malaysia, and other places that would happily have that manufacturing and production. And even better, there are workers in the United States. Our unemployment is at 3.7%, and the labor participation rate has actually gone up. People are going back to work. Our economy is revitalized. So I think those who say it would be terribly destructive to the American economy had it wrong, and I think it will continue to be wrong. And now's our chance. This is our perfect opportunity to address these issues with China, and I don't think that there will be a severe blowback to our economy.
From your lips to God's ears, that would be good news. Kevin, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for your time today and the great work you do at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Check it out at Blaze TV by going to economicwarroom.com. Be well, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say that we have with us a man who I consider to be one of the leading lights of the new Committee on the Present Danger, China. He is Dr. Bradley Thayer. These days, he is a professor of political science at the University of Texas, San Antonio, capping a series of professorships and other fellowships and relationships at outstanding academic institutions, including Tallinn University, Harvard, and St. Anthony's College at the University of Oxford. He's also worked at the Defense Department, the RAND Corporation, and one of my favorite institutions, the National Institute for Public Policy. He's the author, among others, of a terrific book, How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. Bradley Thayer, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back on with you.
Good. Let me ask you, first and foremost, how China sees Hong Kong at the moment. Brad, you've recently written an important piece on the subject with another of our friends and colleagues, Lan Chao Han, at Real Clear Defense, about the importance of Hong Kong's resistance to China. And I wanted you to talk about both of those really important topics, especially against the backdrop of some of the comments President Trump made just yesterday on the subject.
Yes, Frank. Thank you. It's a critically important issue, as you mentioned. We've seen with President Trump's remarks, we see really another element in the broad theme of the international political reaction to the events in Hong Kong, where very few states have stood with the Hong Kongers attempting to resist China's efforts to betray the 1984 agreement that the PRC reached with the British and to suppress Hong Kongers' freedoms and liberties, as in fact the PRC is required to do. So we've seen a failing in the international community to stand with the Hong Kongers, and that has only emboldened the Chinese to do what we have long suspected, which is to bring Hong Kong under the complete control, again in violation of the 1984 agreement of Beijing. So it's a very regrettable element that we're seeing right now. And this is an element really that we should recognize is a new front. If we allow the Chinese to get away with what they're doing in Hong Kong without paying a significant price, it only emboldens them and encourages them in other avenues as well, the South China Sea, East China Sea, or many other avenues. So, and Taiwan, obviously, very, very significantly and importantly. So we're seeing, again, China break its international agreements, not willing to invest and to abide by the agreements they're required to. And that bodes very poorly. That's very dangerous.
It's a bad sign, shall we say, for a whole host of other things, especially as we're sort of frantically trying to get into new agreements with them on trade, notably, and related topics. Let me ask you, on the issue of this breaking of agreements, one of the agreements that the Chinese have is with us as well, if I understand this correctly, concerning respecting Hong Kong's autonomy. This is codified in a U.S. statute, I believe, called the U.S. Hong Kong Policy Act. It makes very clear that if China doesn't respect Hong Kong's autonomy, they will no longer be eligible for the kind of most favored nation sort of loophole that they've enjoyed and profited from massively through exporting via Hong Kong, which has that MFN status. How does that fit into the overall complexion of this as you see it? And should we be using that as leverage at this moment to indicate to the Chinese that there will be real costs to them for engaging in this kind of repression?
I argue that we should do that, that we should impose real costs on Beijing for their behavior. You're right that we have several different levers at our disposal. That agreement is one of them. But again, it demonstrates that there's been a lack of will thus far to confront Beijing over this issue. And that's a worrisome sign in the West. And this is something the Trump administration has done exceptional work in calling attention to the China threat. But the Trump administration can't do it on its own. We need the British to step up. We need the European Union to call attention to Uyghur and Kazakh oppression, as well as the events in Hong Kong and elsewhere. We need the Indians, the Australians, many, many actors in international politics to recognize that what the Chinese are doing is insight into the world to come. As they become more powerful, as they become more dominant, they're going to reshape agreements, values, norms, principles of international politics. And we're not going to like that because it's going to be very anti-liberal, if you will. It's going to be anti-freedom. And so we need to recognize that Hong Kong is one element in a much larger struggle.
The leading edge, really, of what I call the war for the free world. Let me ask you, Bradley Thayer, you're a serious student of China, of course, and the Chinese Communist Party most especially. As you look at what President Trump has said recently, which is effectively, look, it's an internal matter for China, how they deal with Hong Kong. And he's I think, been encouraging of, you know, a peaceful resolution of their disagreements. But that said, how is this being perceived by the Chinese leadership under Xi Jinping, his comments? And would you expect anybody else among the litany of countries in the free world, as you mentioned a moment ago, that would stand up if he's not seen to be doing so himself?
Well, Frank, as you know, the U.S. is the leader in international politics at this stage. And so what Trump says and his actions really are very informative and illuminate the path, really, for many states in international politics. And the fact that his response is not what we would like it to be, again, is disheartening for the Hong Kongers and for those who recognize the full scope of the PRC's ambitions and the Communist Party of China's ambitions. I think it is extremely important to recognize that if the U.S. won't take action, it becomes much harder for the smaller states or major regional allies in the area to take action as well. So we need to recognize, despite the disruption that this may cause in our relationship with the Chinese, in the long run, and even in the short run, it's to our great benefit to force the Chinese to abide by their agreements.
This does not get easier to do, needless to say. It only gets harder.
It will not get easier to do. And Hong Kong is again, the Berlin, really. As Berlin, East and West Berlin, were very significant in the Cold War, there are shades of that in the struggle over Hong Kong. We see with Hong Kong that the PRC would rather sacrifice, if you will, the goose that lays the golden egg, the wealth of Hong Kong, tremendous wealth of Hong Kong, in order to have political control over it, to dominate it now rather than when the 1984 Accord allows them to. So that's very telling. The Chinese are very ambitious, very aggressive in bringing about changes dramatically across the board to the status quo in international politics.
Let me switch gears, if I may, quickly, because you've written another very important piece with Lian Chaohan, another, as I say, mentioned a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, and that is with respect to WeChat. I'm not sure that most Americans know yet much about WeChat. It also has to be said that they seem to be somewhat indifferent to most Americans, that is, to internet tech companies, giants, and so on, exploiting their private data for commercial benefits and perhaps other even more malevolent purposes. So walk us through quickly what WeChat is, Bradley Thayer, and why what's developing now is really such a menace, not just to the people of China, but perhaps the wider world beyond, including our part of it.
Absolutely, Frank. WeChat is a popular social media app owned by China's tech giant Tencent, which has registered more than 1.1 billion global users, including in the United States. But the app has a major cybersecurity risk associated with it. It really is a tool of oppression. It is the eyes, ears, and fists of the communist regime. Its attractiveness is that it allows users to do almost everything that they might need to do, communicate, purchase tickets, meet individuals. Its convenience comes, though, at a Faustian cost. All of the information gathered by WeChat is shared with the Communist Party of China, the security organs of the Chinese government. So as a result of it, anyone who uses it is essentially allowing that metadata to be used by the Chinese police, security forces, and Communist Party. Thus, it becomes a very effective tool of control, of monitoring, even of protesters in Hong Kong, for example. WeChat is very popular in Hong Kong, and individuals there know that using it gives the PRC access to what they're doing, but they use it nonetheless accordingly. So Americans may not be very aware of it, but they're aware of Facebook, for example, and WhatsApp. And we could imagine in the American context, it would be as if Facebook or WhatsApp directly shares information with the United States government, so that any information that they collect, the United States government would know. So that in the hands of a totalitarian government like China is a very worrisome development and a very effective tool for the Chinese Communist Party. It makes policing the citizenry far less expensive, almost cheap.
Right. Dr. Bradley Thayer has kindly agreed to continue our conversation for a second segment. We will be right back with more with Dr. Bradley Thayer right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Dr. Bradley Thayer. Brad, we were talking a bit about WeChat and the kind of intrusive use that the Chinese Communist Party is able to make through its access to incalculably vast quantities of personal information and other data that is communicated through that particular app. But one of the other stories that's breaking today is that the FBI, according to National Public Radio, has been making inquiries of American individuals who had studied at the Yenching Institute, I guess it is, at the Peking University and a prestigious fellowship program to ascertain whether anyone perhaps had approached them while there or subsequently about working for Communist China. And maybe you might comment on that as a man who lives in academia yourself, as a sort of microcosm of a much larger issue of what are the Chinese up to in terms of collecting inside the United States using not only sort of formal espionage techniques, but also the recruitment of lots of people, certainly Chinese nationals here, as well as perhaps Americans.
Frank, it's an enormous problem, and it's a very sensitive and difficult problem as well. The fundamental issue here is that the Chinese government recognized in the late 1980s after Tiananmen that the Soviets made an enormous mistake by isolating themselves from the West. And the Chinese were determined to penetrate, and that is essentially become part of the Western economic ecosystem, the Western technological ecosystem, and the Western university or intellectual ecosystem. And so for decades, Western universities have relied on Chinese students, graduate students in particular, in mathematics, in all aspects of STEM, and elsewhere, to not only train, not only to become educated and to train here, but to become full and active members of the American and more broadly Western academy. But that's come at an enormous cost to the West, because some of these individuals have been involved in espionage or have facilitated Chinese espionage activities against the American hosts or Western hosts. So as you mentioned today, the FBI was urging university officials in the United States to review ongoing research involving Chinese individuals that could have defense applications, which I think is a very prudent step to take. The fundamental problem here is, if you will, the moral issue here is that there are some individuals engaged in espionage, to be sure, but there are many others who are not. And so balancing that fact with Western standards, academic standards of openness, of a free exchange of ideas, free exchange of information, is terribly difficult. Heretofore, the balance has been all on one side, and that is in favor of openness, of exchange, of interacting with Chinese colleagues, Chinese graduate students or undergraduate students as well. And what I think the administration is recognizing and what the FBI with the events today is recognizing is that that has to be, if you will, moved back a bit, perhaps significantly, to combat the espionage threat that the United States faces.
Yeah. In this connection, could you talk a little bit, Brad, about these so-called Confucius Institutes on college campuses across the United States and the role that they may be playing, if not in, you know, actual recruitment of espionage assets or collectors, if you will, at the very least running influence operations in some of America's premier institutions of higher learning?
Indeed, they have, Frank, and it's to the credit of many American universities, University of Chicago first and foremost, which have evicted Confucian Institutes, because Confucian Institutes are recognized by American universities as being tools ultimately of the Communist Party of China. So we should think of a Confucian Institute as a major soft power exercise or agent of influence exercise, where the, if you will, the friendly aspect of it is to tout the wonders of Chinese philosophy, Chinese culture, Chinese language, etc. But of course, the negative aspect is to essentially suppress negative information about China, the way they treat minorities, their ambitions, their directives. So we have seen in recent years, really in the United States, in the American Academy, a turn against Confucian Institutes. And that's the good news. The bad news is Confucian Institutes, that's not widely shared worldwide. And again, Confucian Institutes are worldwide. So step.
It's not even, at this point, as I understand it, really all that widely shared, at least the rolling up of these operations has not yet taken place in the majority of American colleges and universities in which they are situated. But I think it's like 12 out of over 100 that have got these facilities. And I just wonder, as you've watched them, is there evidence that in addition to sort of soft power and influence operations, one of the effects of these institutions is that they can exercise control as a practical matter over what is taught and by whom?
Indeed, they have. And that is suppressing Tibetan activists on American campuses or campuses in Europe, working to police the Hong Kong protests. And the extent that they have been supported at Oxford, for example, and at other institutions. So they are a tool of Chinese control, of Chinese Communist Party control as well. And so as such, they should be recognized as being centers of influence and fundamentally under the control of the Communist Party of China. So
and promoting its agenda is the problem.
Right, and suppressing, including the suppression of free idea, about the exchange of ideas, Tibetan rights, for example, Xinjiang, the rights of Uyghurs, Kazakh, Muslim minority in China, and minorities broadly.
Quickly, just to return to something you talked about a moment ago, because it is a sticky wicket, as the Brits say. How do you wend your way through this minefield of both having adequate situational awareness, I think is the military term for it, about the Chinese threat, the counterintelligence problem that we are confronting here, without, you know, profiling all Chinese Americans or others who might, you know, fall into suspicion? The question, I guess, is when you see, and I don't know whether this is a perfect example of it or not, but something you've called Han centrism at work as perhaps a kind of means of persuading individuals whose families are still in mainland China. Though they may be overseas, they may be working here, they may be studying here, they may be doing research here. Is there reason to be concerned that the Chinese are fully capable of using family members back home coercively to get people who wouldn't otherwise be helping advance the cause of the Hans to do so?
Indeed, I think that's a serious concern that the operations against loved ones in China, understandably and from a human perspective, of course, is very lamentable. But it's often a tool used in espionage with a long history, of course, in the use of spying against other countries is that one of the ways you recruit individuals is by coercing their families. For example, I think we need to recognize that the vast majority of Chinese who are here are in American universities or Western universities more broadly are anti the PRC, are anti the Communist Party of China. And so that's a very positive development. You're not allowed to study abroad without permission and without essentially being monitored. So that's always a problem.
And the social credit score and all the rest of it goes along with this this kind of evaluation. Bradley Thayer, again, we are hard out of time and certainly a lot more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us for a longer conversation again very soon. And we'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, next week. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.